Economic Corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
We take it in turns to act as a sort of executive officer for the week.
Yes.
But all the decisions of that officer have to be ratified at a special bi-weekly meeting.
Yes, I see.
By a simple majority in the case of purely internal affairs.
Be quiet.
But by a two-thirds majority in the case of more...
Be quiet. I order you to be quiet.
Look, you stupid bastard. You've got no arms left.
Yes, I have.
Look.
It's just a flesh wound.
I don't believe I've seen such a display of courage, skill, nerve, grace, stupidity.
I'll do you for that.
Oh, what?
Come here. What are you going to do, bleed on me? I'm invincible.
You're a loony.
The Black Knight always triumphs.
Roundtable Live, Monday through Friday, 1 a.m. till 4 a.m. Eastern Time. Bring your mind, bring your ideas, bring your voice. King Arthur had nothing on us. Here, Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven. Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here, Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
You're listening to Revolution Radio here at freedomslips.com, and coming at you next, this is Carrie Cassidy with Whistleblower Radio Project Canalot. So without much further ado, here's Carrie Cassidy. Take it away, Carrie.
Stretched out and purring, waiting for more.
Strange shade of stone. Hey there, everyone. This is Carrie Cassidy, Project Canalot, Whistleblower Radio, and we are very happy to be here tonight. Michael Schratt is my guest. He is an aerospace historian, and I've done actually two interviews that I remember with him, and I've had him on my radio shows as well, so I have had a number of discussions with him over time, and the guy is really excellent at what he does, so this is going to be an excellent show, I have to say, right from the get-go. And we have also on the front page of Camelot, just so that you can be keeping up with the show, Michael, actually Tommy Hansen has come back to Camelot as a consultant, and he is helping us now behind the scenes on Awake and Aware in a big way, and he is sort of whipping things into shape in terms of the Awake and Aware website, Awake and Aware. 2013.com, and then he also took some time to put Michael Schratt's photos all together in a great sort of little album on the Camelot Forum link, and that has been linked also to the front page of Camelot under his radio show announcement, where you can see it says, I think, photo album or something of that nature. So that's really cool, and you can click there and see all the photos that he's going to be talking about, and he will most likely be very methodical about going through all of them in order, I imagine, because he gave us the order, and hopefully that's how they're displayed, but we'll make it through regardless. So thank you very much to Tommy Hansen for doing that, going way beyond the call of duty, so to speak. Let's see, what else? Actually, Michael, welcome.
Hi, Carrie. How are you?
I'm fine. It's really been a wild and crazy day for me over here. I don't know how it's been for you. How are you doing over there?
Pretty good. Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to be a part of your program tonight.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I was delighted when you contacted me and told me you're going to be at the UFO Congress, which I guess is happening. Is it next weekend? Yeah, that right?
It is next weekend. That is correct.
Okay, that's kind of wild. But I don't know if I'm going to be making it out there. And so we decided to sort of pitch hit with this radio show. And then if I do make it out there, maybe we'll also pick up a video while I'm there with you. But in the meanwhile, I want you to catch us up on where things are at. Give us a story as to kind of where you're at, whether you're still working with the UFO Congress behind the scenes or whatever, and also how you came upon all these incredible photos, and you seem to have done quite a bit of work since we last got together.
Well, I always try to stay busy, Carrie, because it's just such an interesting subject matter. I'm always trying to put new things together, and what we're going to be speaking about tonight, and I just want to be very clear up front, is I didn't make up any of this information on my own. The reference material for the cases that we'll be covering this evening comes from the Center for UFO Studies, NICAP, APRO, Invisible Residence book on USOs by Ivan P. Sanderson, Uninvited Guest by Richard Hall, Magic Eyes Only by Ryan Wood, UFO News Clipping Service, and Wendell Stevens Archive. So the point I want to make is, for anyone who's interested in verifying these cases, they're more than happy to do so, and you'll see that they're based on actual cases.
Okay, so that's very interesting. Yes, of course they're based on actual cases. But you do some work on the photos yourself, don't you?
Well, I mean, instead of just reading about bland text and cases that are obscure and forgotten and neglected for 40 years, it's my job to create a visual aid to attach to these cases so that they become lifelike, so that they're real, something people have something to attach to. It just makes it more realistic, and that's really my interest.
Okay, well, you do a beautiful job. I think everyone will agree. And I, by the way, we have a chat room associated with this radio show on Camelot. So if you go again to the front page of Camelot, which for those who might be new, it's projectcamelot.org, and then just scroll down below the top banners, and you'll see the radio show icon, and you'll see Michael Schratt's name, and then there is a live chat link, and you can just click that. You put in your name, you put in any name you want, no details are needed, and you just hit return. You don't have to fill out anything. Don't fill out any of the spaces there or the questions or whatnot. Just hit return, and you should be online there. And feel free. What I like people to do is put your questions in all caps, and you can feel free to put your questions in there the whole show, and I will try to, scroll back. And then just because this is going to be sort of a high density show, if there's somebody who wants to also, who has my Skype and wants to Skype me the questions, that can always be helpful just to speed things along there. And we do have a call-in line as well on Revolution Radio. So I believe it's on the front page of Revolution. If people want to call in, we will allow for call-ins on the second hour, not the first hour, because we want to give Michael as much space as possible. So, at this point, Michael, could you give us the background on where you're at, how you sort of came upon sort of continuing your studies, and
right.
maybe give us some background there, and then go ahead and launch into everything.
Sure, sure. I've just been researching these unacknowledged special access programs, both the military-industrial complex end of this phenomenon and the actual phenomenon itself. Personally, I believe that a significant majority of what people are reporting as UFOs are on point to affect our own deep black programs. There is a remaining core of reality to this phenomenon, and that's exactly what I want to talk about tonight, because as you know, Kerry, not everything that we're going to be talking about tonight is built by Lockheed Skunk Works. So.
Okay, that's very funny. You guys got to keep up with Michael here because he has a very dry sense of humor. So, but it's all cool. Go right ahead, Michael.
Okay, so I thought, Kerry, we'd begin on what I believe, what I personally believe, be probably the most significant UFO sighting case of all time. I'm talking about the Hudson Valley Boomerang case. This is between 1982 and 1989. And for anyone who wants to follow along, this is illustration number one. So it looks like it's the second column all the way to the right. And you'll see this boomerang chevron flying wing type craft. Interesting, Kerry, that 25,000 eyewitnesses saw this between 1982 and 1989. The sightings continued until 1995, so this had gone on for well over a decade. Now, I want to talk about the cross-section of society of people who saw this vehicle. This includes doctors, lawyers, pilots, air traffic controllers, police officers, and an IBM computer consultant, which we'll get into a little bit later. This was seen over multiple states, Connecticut, New Jersey, Massachusetts, and I want to make a couple of quick points about this particular sighting. Number one, the eyewitnesses stated that the craft was virtually silent or made no noise at all. If it did make a noise, it had this very low-frequency humming noise, the same type of humming noise that you would see or hear if you were standing next to an electrical transformer. So that's number one. Number two, eyewitnesses reported multiple colored lights on the bottom of this thing, perhaps hundreds of multicolored flashing red, green, yellow, and orange colored lights. And then, Kerry, something very interesting. Eyewitnesses reported that there were pipes, tubes, and cylinders on the bottom of the Hudson Valley Boomerang. Some said that it, quote, looked like an inverted oil refinery. The testimony of Ed Burns, who's the IBM computer consultant that we discussed earlier, he said that this thing, quote, looked like a flying city. So the point I'm trying to make is it had this very mechanical, structural bottom surface to the craft. And if you look at this illustration one, I hope you can kind of get a picture of what that thing looked like. Now, also on the bottom were multiple translucent panels. So the eyewitnesses who were directly below this thing on I-95 Turnpike when people pull over to the side of the road and were looking up at this thing, they said it had these translucent panels where you could look up inside the craft and you could see what they described as this structural steel girder and crossbeam construction, somewhat like a truss bridge, Kerry, or the same type of interior skeleton structure that you'd see on the Hindenburg. So I thought that was interesting as well. Next point is that primarily eyewitnesses reported seeing this Hudson Valley Boomerang on Thursday nights, Kerry. So, Kerry, I want to ask you a question. Where have we heard this Thursday night test flight motif before?
I'm afraid I don't remember, but it does sound familiar.
It does kind of sound familiar, right? Well, we do have a pattern recognition here, and I generally don't read things over the air, but if you'll just bear with me on this, Kerry. This is Aviation Week Space Technology, November 11th, 1991, and it's our good friend, Kerry, the Aurora aircraft. I'll just read this very briefly here. It says, two unusually sonic booms heard along the west coast of from San Diego to North Los Angeles, California, may have been produced by high-flying classified aircraft returning to test ranges in Nevada. 25 of the U.S. Geologic Survey's 220 sensor system for pinpointing earthquake epicenters detected the passing shock waves around 6:30 a.m. on October 31st. This is a Thursday. The instruments have recorded shock waves from SR-71 flight and space shuttle reentries in the past. As a result, USGS scientists were determined that the unknown aircraft were flying at speeds up to Mach 3 and altitudes of 23,000 feet. And the flight path carrier was going directly into Groom Lake. And they checked the records. There was no SR-71 flight that day or space shuttle flight that day. So by default, and we don't know whose bird this is, someone was flying probably two classified aircraft on a test mission over the ocean returning to Groom Lake right around Mach 3, and it wasn't the SR-71 or the space shuttle. So the question is, why Thursdays? Why Thursday? If you study what's done at Groom Lake and the flight paths and test patterns of what they're doing out there for unacknowledged special acts programs, they usually always do test flights on a Thursday night because Monday...
Okay, Michael, I don't know what happened with other people, but you just cut out for that whole sentence. You started to say something very interesting about Thursday, and you cut out. Can you repeat that, please?
Sure. What I was trying to...
I just want to say that our website seems to have been hit by an attack. Typical, you know, nonsense going on here. I'm going to try to get, you know, onto live stream while we're on the conversation here and get those photos over the live stream. So you keep talking. I'm going to try to do this. So I apologize to the listener that these photos are, you know, our site is being messed with. I typical bullshit going on. Sorry. Okay. Go
that's
right.
That's okay, Carrie. The point I was making about
I want to hear the Thursday information one more time, just the last couple sentences.
Okay, sure. The point I was making about the Thursday night test flights and the reasoning behind why they pick Thursdays is because Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays are used for preparation. Thursday is reserved for the test flight. Friday is for debrief, and Saturday, Sunday, there's no one there. And so that's why Thursday is reserved for test flights, Carrie.
Okay, fine. So now go right ahead and continue on, and we're going to, as I say, I'll be working as you're speaking.
Okay, that's fine. Okay, now the next point I want to make is immediately after these Hudson Valley boomerang sightings, like I'm talking 2 days afterward, number one, the government tried to explain this away as a group of crackpot ultralight pilots, okay? And that's a comical answer. Everyone knows that ultralights use two-cycle Rotax engines that are very loud that you can hear 5 miles away, but yet eyewitnesses reported that the Hudson Valley boomerang made almost no noise. The other thing to remember, too, Carrie, is that immediately after Hudson Valley boomerang sightings, the U.S. Air Force started sending up a formation of Cessna 02A Skymasters in an effort to confuse the original eyewitnesses into thinking that this is what they saw and not the boomerang. So you can see they were trying to muddy the waters immediately right out of the box.
Okay. Let me tell everyone what I'm doing here. I have these photos in a zip file that are, is this okay, Michael, if I do this, distribute the photos? Is that okay?
Go for it.
Okay. And I've got a link here to my, what's called Dropbox public folder. And let's see how this works for people. Anyone wants to go there, I'm posting it here in the chat for our producer, Ahmad Painter, to pick that up, and then also to post that if they can or they would like to anywhere so people can access it. I'm sorry to say our website is down. I'm going to go onto Facebook, my Facebook page, that's Carrie Lynn Cassidy, and I'm going to also post that the link to my Dropbox on that place, and eventually I'm going to try to get this on live stream as well, so you know, bear with us. But continue on, Michael, while I am, again, trying to get these photos out to people so they can see what you're talking about. The photos are numbered, so this will be helpful to people. Be sure to, you know, and anyone who has access to a very good website or can upload these quickly for people to view, in an easier way, be my guest. Be my guest, okay? These are Michael Schratt's UFO photos, okay? So go ahead, Michael.
Okay, Carrie, no problem. Okay, now, photo number two is a photograph of the Indian Point Nuclear Power Plant. This is located in Buchanan, New York, about 38 miles north of New York City. Stress, Carrie, that on July 24th of 1984, an incredible event occurred at Indian Point Nuclear Power Plant. A 900-foot-wide craft hovered over reactor number three for about 30 minutes, Carrie, and 11 security personnel who were working at the plant saw this happening. This particular craft was silent. There was a 25-knot crosswind that particular evening, so it was very windy. They said it was about 900 feet across. They had orders to shoot on this craft, which we believe they did do. But what's interesting is it violated a known FAA regulation regarding airspace, because when you're over a nuclear power plant, it's absolutely restricted airspace via FAA regulations. So it definitely violated that. But then the most important point, Carrie, is one of these security guards was in a building right next to the reactor here, and he had a remote camera, and he caught all on videotape, Carrie. And he said that this thing was so large that he had to pan the camera 180 degrees to get the whole craft in the frame. And unfortunately, that videotape was confiscated by officials.
Okay, so very interesting. Next photo.
Okay, number three is a very interesting case that took place. This is reported in the Burton Daily Mail, February 17th, 1995. This is photo number three. So this gentleman was driving to work early in the morning, and he saw two white lights off to the right of his position and didn't think too much of it. And what you see on number three is the actual newspaper clipping illustration of what this case actually looked like. So these lights kept getting closer and closer and closer, and finally, whatever this thing was, it was this fantastic flying machine. It hovered right about 70 feet above the roof of his vehicle. So he stopped, pulled over to the side of the road, looked out of his window, and he saw this magnificent machine just hovering above him. It was about 50 feet across. It had two very high-intensity white lights that were indented in the forward section of the vehicle. The aft of the craft, which was elliptical in shape, they had this strange notch cutout that you can see in this newspaper clipping here. But then, again, I want to stress this, Carrie, is we're beginning to see a pattern recognition. He said, according to the eyewitness, he said that the bottom of had pipes, tubes, and cylinders sticking out of it. And this is his quote. The bottom was composed or comprised of plumbing and stuff like car exhausts and silencers. Very interesting. A few minutes later, this thing departed to the east out of his field of view. So, number one, we have the same pipes, tubes, and cylinders reported in the Hudson Valley Boomerang. Now we're seeing it in a craft that was seen in 1994 in England. So we're beginning to see this pattern, Carrie. And if you go to number four, this is my illustration of what I determined that this thing looked like per the actual newspaper clipping, Carrie.
Okay, because I'm opening the live stream, I'm not able to look at this photo right in a second, but I'm going to take your word for it.
Okay, that's fine.
Go right ahead.
Okay.
And hopefully other people are being able to download out of my public folder the other photos as we go here so that they can follow along. Again, any assistance in posting these in a general, you know, page somewhere, just please do so and help us. Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay, so number five is reported in the Burton Daily Mail, March 3rd, 1995. So five is the actual newspaper clipping on this sighting. Now, this gentleman was going to work early in the morning. He was on a motorcycle, and all of a sudden his motorcycle sputtered out, so he pulled over to the side of the road. He could not restart his motorcycle. The next thing he knew, Carrie, he was bathed in a high-intensity white light, and he looked up and saw this gigantic square hovering about 30 feet above him. And this is now on illustration number 6. You can see the illustration of the square. And on the bottom of the square, there were multiple white lights, and then this same pipes, tubes, and cylinders structure on this thing. About 30 seconds later, this strange square pulled off to the side, and the guy who was on the motorcycle determined that it wasn't a square at all. He was looking at the bottom pyramid, and then this thing slowly went away, Carrie. But the problem is, it left his motorcycle completely disabled, and he had to walk this motorcycle 3 miles back to his house, a very long walk. Researchers who eventually caught up with him about 2 weeks later interviewed him about this, and one of these researchers just got this strange urge to pull out a metallic Zippo lighter, and when he put the lighter near the gas tank of this motorcycle, carry, the whole motorcycle was magnetized, and it pulled this lighter out of this guy's hand and shot right to the gas tank.
Incredible. When was this exactly?
This was reported on the Burton Daily Mail, March 3rd, 1995.
Wow.
They don't give a date for the case, but it's a legitimate case. There were other cases similar to this reported as well. But in this case, I mean, there was physical evidence. The guy's motorcycle stalled out. The whole motorcycle was magnetized. Very interesting case. Very interesting.
Okay. I'm trying to figure out, it's a pyramid-shaped UFO, though, because that's very interesting, because we
absolutely
don't have any reports of those kinds of UFOs. They have been more common lately, I think, than they were for many, many years.
Correct. That's correct, Carrie.
Okay. All right.
Okay, so we'll move on now to a very interesting case, the illustration number 7 and illustration number 8. This is February 3rd, 1983, Mobile, Alabama. Lady was returning from visiting a group of friends. She was about 90 minutes from her home. All of a sudden, she heard this massive booming noise, and her car began to rock and shake, and so she pulled off to the side of the road, stopped her vehicle. She got out of her car, and then she looked under the car because she thought that, you know, maybe her transmission fell out or something. Well, that turned out to be okay. She got back into her car.
Okay, we're
going to
go to commercial right back with Michael Pratt.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, and we'll be right back after this message.
The Empire is in peril.
You're probably too young to know, but the Empire is always in some kind of peril.
I may have been overly rude earlier when I called you a pirate.
I may have been overly charitable when I said I wasn't.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Be here Tuesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern Time to catch Roxy Lopez straight from the Valley of the Sun. Her discussions run from chemtrails to sovereignty, aliens to conspiracy facts. So join us for The Truth Denied with Roxy Lopez. Again, that's Tuesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
You ever get tired of being gone? You can't kill the future!
You know what the difference is between you and me?
I make this look good.
Revolution Radio. You're listening to Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Gary, you're live.
Okay, we are, I'm sorry, this is Carrie Cassidy, Project Camelot, Whistleblower Radio. Got too much things going on here trying to get these photos so people can see them because our site has obviously crashed or been attacked or whatever. I guess they didn't want this to be so easy for people. But now the package should be going out there via my Dropbox, and I believe Revolution has also got a copy, so hopefully it will be posted at various places. For those of you that are interested and on live stream, I am now broadcasting, I believe, on live stream, and you should be able to see these photos on the live stream right now as we go through them one at a time. Michael, I'm looking at a photo here, and I'm just trying to figure out if it's the right photo. It has what looks like some kind of a computer board at the bottom of it.
Yes, that's correct. You see all these multiple mirror squares on the bottom of it?
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah. And then the moon is directly below it, Carrie?
Well, I don't know where the moon is in this photo, to be honest.
You should, if you go to, this is illustration 7 and 8, you should see a craft with a moon directly below it.
The pyramid was number 5, so now I just want people to be able to catch up because some people weren't able to see. And to get to our live stream channel, you can actually go to Project Camelot and click on our video interviews, and a live stream channel is click, linked there. But also just go to Project Camelot. Let's see, livestream.com/Project Camelot Live. So livestream.com/Project Camelot Live is our live channel. And as I say, these photos are showing up there as we speak, I believe. So we've got the pyramid right now. Number 5 and number 6 were the pyramid UFOs.
That's correct.
You were just talking about those. So now I'm going to go to number 7. I just wanted to give those photos a bit of time on the screen. Okay, so now we've got the moon right below this amazing-looking, completely bizarre craft. So go right ahead.
Bizarre craft, no doubt about it. Okay, so just to follow up now, this was 3rd, 1903, Mobile, Alabama. A woman was driving back home from visiting friends. She heard this big boom noise. Her car started shaking. She pulled off to the side of the road, got out of the car, looked under the car to see if the transmission fell out. That was okay. She got back in her car, proceeded down, and then she saw this like opening or gravel pit, and she saw this massive craft that you see here in illustration 7 and 8. And I want to understand that these are computer-generated forensic composite illustrations based on this April Bulletin report. Now, she stated, these are her reports here, that this thing was about 70 to 80 feet high, was 210 feet wide. It was black in color. The whole thing had these rivets on the outside exterior. She said it could have been something that was man-made. That was her, kind of a sense of that. Now, look on the top, verse 7, I'm going to start on top. She said that there was this transparent deck section on the top with very interesting humanoid-looking beings who were wearing these tight-fitting one-piece flight suits that were white in color. She said they looked to be about 5 feet 10 inches tall. Below that was another transparent section, a little bit smaller than the one above it. Now, below that, you'll see this opening with a door that was closing from right to left. And she said that she got a view of the floor of this thing, and she said it looked like it a black asphalt road. And as this door was closing to the left, on that left side wall, once again, we have this report of these pipes, tubes, and cylinders sticking out. So this is now the fourth time we've heard of this as well. Now, below that is another deck of humanoid-looking beings. But she said that these actually paid attention to her. The ones on top, they were completely oblivious to the eyewitness who saw this. She said, quote unquote, it looked like they were changing shift. They didn't pay attention to her at all. But the ones on the bottom actually did. The bottom surface of this craft, Terry, was a cross-shaped bottom section composed of hundreds of these 12-inch square mirrors on the bottom. This thing slowly departed her field of view, and that was this sighting. So this was February 3rd, 1983.
Okay. I'm not sure what's going on. I just kind of got a call from the Revolution Station. It's calling in on my other line. So I don't know if we lost you there, Michael, for a moment or not. You were coming in fine for me. I'm trying to see what's going on in the chat because usually they can communicate and tell me what's going on. Ahmad, are you on the line? Are we on? Are we live?
Oh yeah, we're still live. We've been joined by Hawk.
I see. Okay. Well, thank you very much for that. This is an amazing, amazing craft, I have to say, Michael. And this is, explain to me. Did you draw this based on the description?
I did not draw this. I used the April Bulletin. This is the 1983, volume 32. This is where this comes from. This illustration was done by John McNeil.
Okay. All right. Well, and was it this colorful and everything?
He did everything. He did the whole thing. I provided him with the details. I mean, I can only take these things so far. I'm not the world's greatest illustrator by any means. I mean, he's certainly better than me. I want to make sure he gets the credit for that for sure.
Okay, it looks like Nighthawk would like to say something. Go right ahead, Nighthawk.
Yeah, Carrie Kid, I'm trying to get links to these photos. I'm getting plastered in email and in our chat room. People that want to know where the photos are, could you throw me the links, please, so I can get everybody happy?
I have been posting them in, I thought I gave them already to you guys, but here's my live stream link where they go right now and view each one at a time.
I mean, I have hundreds of people over here in the chat room and in my email, and I'm getting beat up. So all I need is the links, if you could.
Okay, yeah. I just typed that one because I'm listening to you here. So hold on one second. Let me do this. /project.
Thank you very much.
Okay. That is the link. Ahmad, I have been pasting. I pasted the links already in this chat. You should be able to get them. One says Dropbox. This is where you download from. It's a zip file. And that link, it is. I see it. I'm in the chat with you, unless you're in a different chat, which you may be. So let me grab this link here. Are you in a different chat? Because I got Ahmad talking to me on one chat. I think maybe you're on a different chat. So let me give you on another one. Here's the live stream link, and then let me get the other link. The other link, what it is again, I actually put it on my Facebook page as well, so it is there. It is a link to what's called Dropbox, and Dropbox is a place where you can go download. Go into my public folder, click on that link, and you should see the public folder. You should be able to click into it and see the Michael Schratt photos labeled as a folder, and then just double click and they should start downloading into your desktop. That should be for anyone who wants to those photos, including yourself. Okay, so you should have both those links. The actual link that was on our website is still on the website if the website allows you to access it, but I don't know. So hopefully. Okay, great. Okay, sounds like he got that. So again, I urge Ahmad Painter, if you could take the live stream link and post that, because we are live on live stream right now, I believe, and the photos are live. Sorry for the technical details here and the trouble. I know people want to see these photos, and we are getting them out there. Don't worry, they will be available even after the show, and you'll be able to listen again to the show. So all of this is going to be worked out. It's not a problem, so everyone just stand by. Okay, Michael, are you there?
Yes, I am here.
Excellent. Okay, so let's move on. I'm going to go and get the next photo, whatever photo you want me to get. Is it number 8?
Nope, I'm saying we're the one we just talked about. Number 9 is the next one.
Oh, so you want me to go to number 9? Okay.
Yes.
Okay, and hold on one second here because I just need to focus it. This is a great photo, by the way. Another great photo. I mean, we've got a lot of great photos here. So, okay, it's live on live stream, and I'm going to try to open another computer to see if I can make sure what people are looking at, but it should be fine. Go right ahead.
Okay, so number 93 is the famous Miss Mansfield, Ohio, Omni helicopter case of October 18th, 1973. I challenge any skeptic, anyone who's listening to this radio broadcast, this transmission, I challenge any skeptic to debunk this case. It is ironclad. It cannot be debunked. I challenge anyone to try to rip this case apart. Now, the background is, this was October 18th, 1973, Mansfield, Ohio. They were on a nighttime training mission. There were 4 crew members on a U.S. Army Reserve UH-1 Huey helicopter. One of the crew members saw a red light approaching at a very high rate of speed. They estimated it to be about 700 mile an hour closure rate. So the pilot, thinking quickly, decided to take matters into his own hands, and he cut the power, put the helicopter in a dive, and started descending rapidly. At that point, this strange cigar-shaped craft, which was about 6 feet in length, it was a gunmetal gray metallic in color. It had one white light on the front and one red light on the left section of the vehicle, and there was a dome on top. It started hovering above this helicopter as it was descending. The very next second, Carrie, this cigar-shaped craft shot down a green beam of light and hit this helicopter. And when it hit the helicopter, remember, the helicopter is descending as quickly as it can to get away from this craft. When that green beam hit this helicopter, it started ascending at a rate of 1,000 feet per minute. So this guy, he cut the power, put it into a dive. Then this green beam of light hit the helicopter, and it started going up at 1,000 feet per minute. When it hit around 38 feet above the ground, there was a thump, and then this thing flew away. And ground observers saw it, Carrie. Very well-documented case.
Yeah, and absolutely fascinating. Wonderful. I can't believe this is an incredible, incredible shot. You know, the obviously the again, is it the same illustrator?
No, I did this one, and I got a little bit of help from my friend at Open Minds.
Oh wow! Okay, awesome. Well,
this is a joint adventure here. So.
Okay. Well, wonderful. Okay, wonderful. Yeah, it's a great shot, and please continue.
Okay, we'll go on to the next one. So the next one is number 10. And number 10 is a case that occurred on January 1st of 1970. This was at the Cowichan District Hospital in Vancouver Island. This nurse's name is Doreen Kendall, and she was part of this very interesting sighting. She was a very intuitive person. And if you go to illustration number 11, that is a picture of the actual hospital that this took place in. And she noticed that her patient was getting very restless. So she took it upon herself to pull open the curtains. And when she looked out the window, the third floor here, she looked out the window and saw what you see on illustration number 12. A dish-shaped craft that was about 50 feet in diameter. It was about 70 feet away from her window, and it was tilted at about a 5-degree angle to the left, which you see here on illustration number 12. And she was just in awe at seeing this thing. This was very interesting, exciting. Now, she also was able to see there was these two beings in these black flight suits that had kind of like head dressing on. In back of these two beings that were in this transparent bubble canopy, there were these computer screens, there were these buttons, switches, dials, and levers. There were two stools in this craft as well. and the one that was furthest away from her turned around and saw the nurse looking at these two beings in this flying saucer. When that happened, the being on the far side tapped the shoulder of the gentleman who was closer to her. Then they both turned around. The gentleman to the right, who was a little bit closer to the nurse, he pulled this lever, Carrie, and then this thing flew away at a high rate of speed. Very well-documented case, Carrie. You can't make this stuff up.
No, it's, and wow, this again is an incredible shot, I have to say. What a great drawing. Really fabulous. Okay, next one.
Okay, so we're going to move on to 13. I really like this next case, Carrie. It's just got some really good document back it up. Now, this is the White Sands Missile Range case. This is on June 14th of 1949. This was a naval upper atmospheric test where they launched a rocket, and when this rocket reached a speed of 1,000 feet per second, something very interesting happened. Keep in mind, this is 1949 we're talking about here. What happened is when this missile reached 2,000 feet per second, or about 1,363 miles per hour, two 20-inch diameter metallic spheres paced it as it was going up. So there was one on the left and one on the right. That's what you see in illustration number 13. Now, after a few seconds, the one on the left dropped down below, moved over to the right, went right through the exhaust of the missile, and then joined the other sphere on the right. And then 2 seconds later, both spheres departed and left this missile way behind. So, Carrie, this thing was 2,500 feet per second. So I ask all the listeners out there, who in 1949 could build a 20-inch diameter sphere that had no wings, no propellers, no visible means of propulsion, that could pace a rocket going 2,000 feet per second? It was tracked on multiple stations, and there were multiple eyewitnesses, sources, NICAP, and uninvited guests by Richard Hall. Very well-documented case.
Okay, and again, you know, it's very interesting that you're doing this, Michael, because I have to say this is a great way for people to really, you know, look at these cases, and I know Richard Hoagland has written UFOs in the National Security State, Volumes 1 and 2, and he describes and goes through the stories, and he's a very eloquent writer. It is so valuable to have these kinds of photos, you know, where people don't have to do a lot of the legwork of visualizing whatever it is and possibly coming up with the wrong kind of visualization when it's so clearly documented in this way. So I just want to say thank you for that. It was a real brilliant idea of yours to actually approach it this way.
Well, thank you, Carrie. That was my whole thrust from the very beginning of doing this 20, 25 years ago. I mean, the idea of illustrating these obscure cases just seems so appealing to me because they have been left dead and stranded in these old files, never to see the light of day. So I thought, what better, you know, campaign or crusade could there be than to resurrect these cases and get them out to the people? That's just exactly what I wanted to do.
Okay, we're having some interference with your speech. There's a, I don't know if you're too close to the mic or what happens. I don't really know because they have to explain to me what's going on there. But just maybe if you back off a little bit on your phone receiver so there's no static. But otherwise, the sound is fine, and let's continue. Let me say that, you know, people, researchers are really the unsung heroes of the UFO movement, and without them, we'd pretty much be dead in the water. So kudos to you, and kudos to researchers that spend hours and hours and hours researching information that they get and then cross-correlating and coming up with the information, you know, in a sort of cogent form that we can then make sense of. And Camelot has really tried to front and center you guys, and you've done a great job. So let's continue. I've got slide number 14. Is that the one you want now?
Yes, 14 is correct, Carrie.
Okay, this is, again, an amazing picture, I have to say.
Okay, so Illustration number 14 is the famous Snake River Canyon UFO encounter. This was August 13th, 1957, in the Twin Falls, Idaho region. Now, there were three primary eyewitnesses, a father and his two sons, who were in a boat on the river about 300 feet away from where he was located. All three eyewitnesses reported seeing a very strange-looking craft drop into canyon at about 1,000 miles per hour, Carrie, and they reported it as being looking like Abraham Lincoln's top hat, but take the top hat and chop off the top two-thirds, leaving only the one-third on the bottom, then stretch it out to an elliptical shape, and that's what this craft looked like. There was an engine pod on either side of the craft that was not this flame, but he said it made no smoky contrail, and it was about 1,000 miles per hour as it was passing by. And it was his interpretation that it was using some type of atomic energy for propulsion force, Carrie.
Okay. Well, yeah, and I'm simply trying to follow along here. So this what are you saying is the what do you call it? What powers this?
Yeah, he said that there was an engine pod on either side of the craft, or either side of this top hat looking craft here, and then immediately after the engine pods, there was a very strange looking flame, but he said that it didn't leave any smoke or contrail, and it was his assessment, according to the Twin Falls Times News report of August 15th, 1947, he said that this was some type of atomic energy this thing was using. This is his word, Gary.
Interesting. It sort of makes you think that perhaps this could have been one of ours, right? An experimental craft of some kind.
It seems like it, but again, being 1947, August 13th, this is even before the first flight of the F-86 Sabre jet. But yet this thing is screaming through the canyon at 1,000 miles an hour, navigating all the twists and turns. At 1,000 miles an hour, at that low altitude, that'd be nearly impossible for pilots of that time to navigate such close quarters. So I can't tell you who it is, but okay. It's there.
All right. We're going to keep going because, believe it or not, we're almost 10 minutes shy just of the end of the hour and going into the second hour. So we're going to have to kind of zip along because you've got a lot of photos that I'm sure people want to hear your explanation for every single one.
Sure, that's fine, Carrie. So let's move on to number 15. Number 15 was seen by a farmer. This was on May of 1978. I'll give you a specific date. But this happened at night. He saw a brilliant flash of light, started walking out into his farm, and he saw this 9-foot diameter dish-shaped craft which landed in his field. He said that the top looked like this mushroom section. Underneath the top dome of the craft, there was these strange slotted thin windows that went around the circumference of the craft. He also said that there was a ramp that extended out from it. Then he decided he'd try to get within 25 feet of it, and when he walked up to it close, that ramp folded in, and then the thing took off at a slow rate of speed.
Radio at freedomslips.com, and we'll be right back after this message.
The finder of lost children and missing persons.
Monique Lassan.
Surveillance, civil and criminal investigations.
I investigate.
No, I am the chosen one.
Do not underestimate the power of good.
and do not dismiss the strength of the child.
Yes, every Thursday afternoon on Revolution Radio, come join our very own eye investigatrix, Monique Lassonde, with her private eye X-Files.
Private Eye X-Files, every Thursday from 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
I realize it's very hard for you to take in. What is your destiny to find the golden child?
Will you fight? No! We will run! And we will live!
Shame on you!
This could be the greatest night of our lives. But you're gonna let it be the worst.
And I guarantee a week won't go by in your life you won't regret walking out, letting them get the best of you.
Well, I'm not going home.
We've got too far!
And I'm gonna stay right here and fight for this lost cause.
A day may come when the courage of men fails.
But it is not this day.
The line must be drawn here. This far, no farther.
I'm not saying it's gonna be easy.
You're going to work harder than you ever worked before.
But that's fine. We'll just get tougher with it.
If a person grits his teeth and shows real determination...
Failure is not an option.
That's how winning is done.
Believe me when I say...
We can break this army here.
And win just one for the Gipper.
But I say to you, what every warrior has known since the beginning of time...
You've got to get mad.
I mean plumb mad dog mean.
If you would be free men... Then you must
fight to fulfill that promise. Let us
cut out their living guts
1 inch at a time.
And they will know what we can do.
Let no man forget how menacing we are. We are lions.
You're like a big bear, man.
This is your time.
Seize the day.
Never surrender.
Victory or death.
That's the Chicago.
Who's with me?
Clap. Don't let him die. Clap.
All right. Let's fly.
And gentlemen in England, now abed, shall know
my name is the law.
But I tell our enemies that they may take our lives, but they'll never take
our Independence Day.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. One world coming together to bring freedom home. You don't need to expect us. We're already here. Every Tuesday afternoon on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, we present our goddess spiritual warrior, Kathy Bilski.
I command. I call to the architect of the universe's divine creators and ask for permission to quantum leap the world in all life forms on all planes and dimensions, seen and unseen, connected with planet Earth, to let us go beyond our known potential into the greatest unknown golden age the universes and worlds and all planets have ever experienced.
Kathy teaches the spiritual truth so that you may create a better life and be able to make positive changes for yourself and for the planet. She helps us remember that we are not powerless, but very creative spiritual beings having an Earth experience. Time to quantum leap into the age of divine enlightenment and let Kathy provide you with the tools of knowledge you need to awaken spiritually. That's the Quantum Leap Show. Let light unite every Tuesday from 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern Time on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
Now you can share the topics that drive the discussions of your favorite talk shows with TalkStream Live's topic-driven talk radio. List and promote real-time talk radio topics or post the topics that you want to hear. Hot topics are tweeted and retweeted and include simple click-to-listen audio links. The future of talk radio is topic-driven talk radio. Available now at TalkStreamLive.com.
How dare you, sir?
How dare you?
No, how dare you?
No, no, how dare you?
How dare you? No, no, my, how dare you?
You dare to damn me?
How dare you? How dare me when I how dare you? You big
sleepyhead.
Hello, all. Thanks for tuning in to Revolution Radio. We are the number one public access, commercial-free internet talk radio station on the web, with between 12 and 16 hours of live programming per day, bringing you news, politics, entertainment, and just plain human interactive talks with our extremely informative and successful nightly open-caller roundtables. And how do we do this? Through the support of volunteers and donations from good listeners like you. So if you're digging what you hear, and we are bringing you an entertaining and informative service, please visit our site support page and donate to the cause. Keep us live. Keep us kicking. Help us bring you the talk. We are already here. Help keep us here. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. Revolution Radio!
God, the pressure!
Thank you for tuning in to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. If you plan to call in and speak with one of our hosts, please turn down your radio and separate yourself from any background noise and wait for the area code to be called on before you speak. And don't forget, Revolution Radio freedomslips.com is listener supported. So stop by the homepage, freedomslips.com, visit the site support area to help support the host you're listening to's airtime. Thank you. Revolution Radio freedomslips.com, where the truth never sleeps.
This is Lorian Fenton from the Fenton Perspective. You're listening to Revolution Radio. And now we take you back to your host, Carrie Cassidy, and Whistleblower Radio.
Hello. Okay, this is Carrie Cassidy, Project Camelot, with the radio, and sorry, we have all kinds of weird technical things going on over here. Oh, God. Michael, are you there?
I'm still here, Carrie. I'm still here, Carrie.
Okay. You shouldn't, I don't know, let kids play with fire or, I don't know, sort of radio talk show hosts try to orchestrate visuals while they're talking, but at any rate, I think I'm back live on live stream, and we're still showing this craft here. So are we on to the next one, or did you want to say more about this particular one?
We're on number 16 and 17.
Okay.
And this is July 1st, 1995, in France. And the primary I witnessed was a man by the name of Maurice. He was working in a laboratory at the time. He heard a high-pitched whining noise. Turned to a side section where there were some rocks there, and he saw a strange football-shaped craft with these lunar lander legs. And then about 30 seconds later, he noticed two beings that were about 4 feet tall, who were also picking some lavender. One of the beings turned to the side, which you see in number 16, pulled out this long tube-shaped device and shot this gentleman. He was paralyzed, and then these beings jumped back into the ship and flew away at a 45-degree angle. And illustration number 17 is based off the newspaper clipping from 16.
Okay, that was 17.
I'm still here.
Okay, you said there's a newspaper clipping. You're talking, because I have something different on number 17, this little cigar-shaped craft.
Yes, that's correct.
It's filled in this time. It's not such a cartoon, right?
That is based off 16 report. That is really based off the original report here.
I see how it goes. Okay, so the first one is like a sort of a drawing that's more...
Correct. That's dynamic, correct.
And the second one is more of this sort of a painting, more like a photo.
Kind of, yeah. Just wanted to give people an idea of what the field may have looked like when he was there, so...
Okay, well, yeah, great. So go right ahead. This is...
Okay, so we're going to move on to 18. 18... took place February 10th, 1977 in Tucson, Arizona. Two primary eyewitnesses were looking outside their living room window that night and noticed a red light approaching them. They were near a schoolyard at the time, and as this light got closer, they got out of the house and looked as this thing approached even closer, and it turned out it wasn't just a light, but it was 3.5-foot diameter tube-shaped craft that was 7 feet tall. On the forward section of this craft was a transparent window, and then behind the window, there were these bars that you would see at a jailhouse. In back of these bars, Carrie, there was this strange being that was inside a inflated suit. And the eyewitness tried to get up and touch this particular craft, but she was about too far away, and then this thing slowly moved off to the left of her field of view.
Okay, and this is so bizarre, but what a great drawing.
This was reported in April Bulletin, Volume 25, Number 8, February, and that's the reference for that. So now we'll move on to 19 and 20. Interesting case that took place in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, August 1967. A chiropractor was riding his horse on an Indian reservation when his horse started going crazy. And a few seconds later, a low-flying cloud that was about 70 feet across kind of lowered itself near his area, and immediately there are a 40-foot diameter dish-shaped craft emerged from the cloud, and it has these very interesting vent-like structures that you can see on illustration number 20. Also shows up on 19. These vent-like structures on the bottom were counter-rotating, and there was this blue electrical arc going around this craft. This may have been what the horse was reacting to. No more than 30 seconds later, this thing flew back into the cloud and then departed to the south.
Okay. Wow. Bizarre pictures here. And is this number 20 as well?
This is number 20 as well. That's correct. So 19 gives you the bottom view and side view. 20 is a 3D illustration based on the original sketch.
Wow. And who did the illustration number 20?
Number 20, I did that one.
Wow. You say you're not good, but I think you're great. I mean, these are amazing.
Oh, it's not as good as John McNeil, but it gives you an idea of what it looks like.
Wow, this is just incredible. Okay, go to the next.
Yeah, let's go to the next one. And the reference for this is Canadian UFO Report, issue number 1-2, spring of 1971. So we have a documentation on that. Okay, next one. This is number 21. This took place on November the 6th of 1976, Virginia Beach, Virginia. And this occurred in the backyard of Mrs. Barbara Nielsen, who saw this bell-shaped craft that was hovering above her backyard field. And it was tilted at about a 10 degree to the left-hand side, which you see here on 21. I did a kind of a 3D drawing with an ice. 22 shows you the bottom. It was about approximately 5 feet in diameter, 5 high. It had a series of portholes square cut in the lower circumference of the bottom of the craft. And then Carrie, she's reported that these yellow lights on the bottom were different sizes, but then there was this Times Square scrolling letters that were scrolling across the very midsection of the bottom of the craft, just like you would see on Times Square. So a very interesting report coming from the Wendell Stevens collection.
Okay, so Wendell Stevens, now that's a whole nother, you know, story actually, because many people, you know, you should say, let's give some background here, that Wendell Stevens has passed on and that his entire library is really a special library.
It's a very special library.
And this was actually purchased. Was it purchased by John Rao, who runs the UFO Conference?
That is correct.
Okay. Did this particular slide come from there?
Yes, it did.
Okay. Very, very interesting, because I've always wondered what he's doing with that library.
This has never been seen by anyone in APRO, in QFOS. You're the first person to see this, actually.
Oh, that's very cool. Okay. So, well, me and all the listeners who are getting the firsthand look at this, and let's continue. So, slide number 22.
Okay, so 21 and 22 are the ones we just discussed. Now, if we move on, 23.
Okay, so
23.
Hold on 1 second, because I didn't put 23 on the screen soon enough. So I wanted people to see this is the color drawing of an enlargement of the one before. So it's the same vehicle. It's just a better look at it, and it's a great shot. So I just wanted to slow you down a little bit there. Okay, go right ahead with number 20.
Okay. 23 is a bizarre case, Carrie, that took place on November the 9th of 1979. A forestry worker with the Livingston Development Corporation was inspecting some young trees in the forest. This is in the vicinity of Livingston, Scottsdale, Scotland, United Kingdom. And he was riding in one of their official trucks. And when he got above this small hill, he saw this very strange sphere-looking craft. It was about 20 feet in diameter. It had a very strange collar around the midsection, and there were these portholes running along the circumference of it. And so he was just really shocked at seeing this, and then completely unknown to him, two smaller spheres popped out of the bottom of this thing, and these spheres looked like World War II mines, the kind that they would lay down during naval operations. They looked like these very strange mines. And these smaller spheres started approaching him, and they attached themselves to his bottom pant leg and knocked him off balance and started pulling him toward this craft. There was a very strange, kind of like smell, he said. He said it smelled like truck brakes burning. There was this very strange odor, and then he went unconscious. And when he woke up, he was about 300 feet from where he was originally. He had to crawl back to his, and he barely got home. This is reported April Bulletin, July of 1980. So a very well-researched case, extremely bizarre.
Absolutely. Okay, we're going to have to just speed through these. I do want to take some questions if we have any time whatsoever. So I'm going to let you go. Number 24.
Okay, number 24, interesting case. A woman was in a cabin. She was combing her daughter's hair, of all things, and she had the light off in the cabin. She noticed a strange craft descend and hover just above their pier on the lake. This is August 1962 in Lake Mulville, northern Minnesota. And when she could see that the light inside this was backlighting three humid-looking beings that were looking at her. And when she saw that they were looking at her, she got out of her cabin, started going down to see this thing, and then this thing departed at a low rate of speed off to the west. So very interesting case. April Bulletin, Volume 21, 2, October 1972. Let's move on to the next one. Number 25, very interesting. This is a well-known case. This is the Reunion Island, France, of July 31st, 1968. This gentleman was picking his rabbits when he turned the corner and saw this particular egg-shaped craft. He said it was about 5 meters in length, 2.5 meters tall. It had these strange Michelin men-type creatures in this vehicle. The exterior left and right portions of the vehicle were kind of a bluish color, but the transparent section in the mid portion of this vehicle, And then on top and bottom were these clear glass pedestals. About 30 seconds after this sighting, Carrie, there were a bright flash, and then the beings and the craft disappeared altogether. Very large case.
Okay. Next.
Okay, so we'll move on now to 26. This took place on June 29th, 1964. A gentleman was driving down the road when he saw this particular strange top-shaped craft. He said that it made a hissing sound like multiple snakes, very unusual. It dropped down near his hood, going 65 miles an hour. It was pacing his vehicle for about 3 minutes. Left, it came back one more time and spewed this oily residue all over the hood of the vehicle that they could not get off the vehicle. Interesting case. So this is June 1964, Lovina, Georgia. Moving on to the next one, Carrie, 27, very well-researched case. This took place 2:30 a.m., July 23rd, 1948. Two Eastern Airlines DC-3 pilots were flying in an altitude of about 5,000 feet. They noticed a white light approaching their vicinity, and they could see right now that they were going to collide with this thing. So the pilot of the DC-3, the captain, put this thing into a hard left bank, and this cigar-shaped craft dropped down past near the right wing, then made an abrupt pull-up, shot away at a high rate of speed, but both the pilot and the co-pilot got a very good look at this thing. They described it as a torpedo-shaped object about 100 feet in length with two rows of these burning magnesium white lights running along the length of the country. Very well-researched case, also reported in the Air Force Project Blue Book.
Okay, excellent. Next one.
Okay, so we're moving on to 29. Now, this is another one of these cases where I want to explain where I'm getting this. Anyone who doubts the validity of these cases can go to NICAP.org, click on cases by date, and just spend 20 minutes perusing through the 1952 cases and reading the actual reports from pilots who are seeing these things.
We're getting a lot of feedback from your microphone.
Sorry about that.
So this would be July 22, 1952, Trenton, New Jersey, where multiple pilots saw this shaped craft. They tried to lock onto these things. They always departed at a high rate of speed. They could not be intercepted by F-90 for fighter aircraft. And it just goes to show you, Carrie, that if you spend just 10 minutes looking at these, no one can walk away from these NICAP reports. I think that this is just not going on. It's absolutely going on. Okay, next one. We are now on 30. This took place in late 1956 at Castle Air Force Base in California. There was a dogfight between an F-86 and a dish-shaped craft. This went on for like 20 minutes. Every time the F-86 got somewhat within range of the craft, it departed at a high rate of speed, then came back again. Very well-reported case. This would be late 1956, Castle Air Force Base, California. Next one, 31. This is the 1952 UFO crash retrieval in Mojave Desert, California, reported by Leonard Stringfield in Retrievals of the Third Kind, published in July 1978, abstract number 2. Eyewitness reported that it was seen and tracked coming down on Edwards Air Force Base radar, approximately 50 feet in diameter. This is what you see here on number 31. If we move on to 32, Carrie, I show it being brought into Edwards Air Force Base. More than likely, it was to North Base Complex, because that's where all the secret things happen, at Edwards North Base Complex. 33 shows it inside the hangar. It was temporarily stored at Edwards Air Force Base until it was shipped by truck, according to the report, to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. That's what you see, 33. 34, the eyewitness reported in this case that there were a number of humanoid bodies that were retrieved from this particular case. Don't know if they went to Wright-Patterson, but we've heard reports they were also stored in these cryogenic-type cylinders. So that would be 34.
Okay.
Moving on to 35. This is the UFO crash retrieval, May 18th, 1953, Kingman, Arizona. There's a couple of points I want to talk about here on this one. The first thing to remember is that there were multiple events associated with the Kingman crash. The original Kingman event was not a crash retrieval. In point of fact, it was a forced landing because this particular craft accidentally flew into a triangular high-power radar net and went down, embedded itself 16 inches into the soil at a 20-degree angle from the horizontal plane. There were four humans were recovered. They were alive. This is from Arthur G. Stanzel, who's an atomic bomb specialist who boarded a blacked out bus and made a 6-hour trip on a dusty, sandy road all the way from Phoenix to Kingman, Arizona. There were also 40 engineers and specialists who were on the craft. And once they recovered it, Terry, they put it on an M-25 ink transporter and went directly to Area 51. So that was number 35. So we'll move on to...
Very, very interesting. Yeah, I really love these because these are really old cases, a very famous case, the Kingman case. Most people have not seen a rendition of the craft that's quite that good. So thank you.
So number 36, Terry, I just wanted to point out that if you go back to the ancient Sanskrit texts of India that date 2,000 years before the time of Christ, they talk about these flying machines that use this liquid mercury vortex engine. And if you do any research on the Nazi Bell, they also talk about a liquid mercury vortex engine. So I'm just wondering, does the technology carry date back a lot earlier than we previously thought? And we're just rediscovering this technology now. That appears to be the case.
Okay, excellent. We have to move really quickly. If there are certain cases you definitely want to get to, Michael, just giving you a highlight here. We are on number. We're going to go to number 37 now.
Okay, we're going to go to number 37. Is our very good friend Ben Rarick. We spoke about him many times before. I just wanted to highlight something that Ben stated. There is something called Project Snowbird. We don't know exactly what it is, but we know that it does exist because I was able to track down a rare copy of OVNI World Journal 1993, where there's a reference article about a telephone conversation that took place between Ben Rich and the former head of Testers Model Corporation Special Programs. This was in 1991, May 30th of 1991. He called Ben and, you know, asked Ben, hey, Ben, what can you tell me about Project Snowbird? And Ben's reply is written in this article, and Ben says, quote, "If I used the word snowbird, I'd be in jail." These are Ben's words himself. He's essentially acknowledging that there is such a project called Project Snowbird.
Yeah, that's a great. I love that. A denial of a denial, but absolutely.
Yes.
So there is such thing as Project Snowbird. If I use those words, I'd be in jail.
That's
perfect.
Exactly
then,
what he said.
We have the technology to take E.T. home.
Yes.
And many other very famous quotes. Fascinating guy.
Exactly. 38, Carrie, is a copy of Ben's retirement certificate. And I just wanted to highlight that. I find it very interesting that on the very night that the F-117 started bombing Baghdad, Ben Rich was giving a talk at his retirement party. He's the father of a stealth fighter, and they were bombing Baghdad the very day he retired, which is very interesting timing there. I don't know if there's a connection, but very interesting. So 39 is that article I talked about where Ben Rich talks about Snowbird. 40, Kerry, is a picture inside the Lockheed Skunk Works in Burbank, California. This is the assembly line for the F-17. Now, 41 shows you Burbank Airport with the Skunk Works, because this is where they were located before they moved to Air Force Base 42, Palmdale, up in the high desert. And one thing I want to point out to here is that we can't go into too many details because we're restricted on time, but there's an article that talks about the strange death of General Robert Bond, who was killed in the test flight of a specially modified test aircraft on April 26, 1984. But in this article, they talk about how there are flights of U.S. Air Force Lockheed C-5 military transports that fly into Lockheed Burbank plant, which is number 41 here, in the dead of night, and then they open up that cargo door, which is in the front of C-5, and then under the cover of darkness, Lockheed engineers and personnel, maintenance personnel, load into the front of the C-5 these strange shapes that are covered by tarps. No one knows what it is, but then they close the nose of the C-5. This thing takes off and heads to Area 51 for assembly. So this has constantly been going on at the Skunk Works, and then they move to Palmdale. 42 is a good picture of John Andrews. He was head of Special Projects Division at Tester's Model Corporation. He was a good friend of Ben Rich, and they would play this Scrabble game for years, and that's how number 43 came about. 43 is a picture of the SR-75 penetrator. The actual aircraft is not called the SR-75. It's not called the Aurora. A better program name for that vehicle is probably Brilliant Buzzard. And I want to highlight the fact that on 43, that particular craft uses the exact same engines as the B-1 bomber does. This is the General Electric F-101 turbofan engines. And if you look here, you can see the parasitic aircraft on top. That is launched in a speed of about Mach 1.2 to 1.3. Now, the bottom mothership we believe to be about 85% correct. The top parasitic aircraft was an invention by John Andrews himself personally, so we both think that that is generally the correct configuration. But he did get the top mothership correct.
Very interesting. All right. Smaller craft, huh?
The smaller, correct. So 44 carry is the aft view of the mothership aircraft. Now, I want to point out here that the takeoff roll of this aircraft is 9,000 feet, okay? And according to Air Force spec, you must have 3x takeoff roll at your Area 51. That's why Area 51 has a 27,000-foot runway, because if you use up 9,000 feet of runway and you have two engine failures, you're going to need 18,000 feet for a possible rollout. That's why there's a 27,000-foot runway at Area 51. Okay.
Okay, well, I have questions for you, but I can't ask them because I'm afraid we're not going to get through all the way. This is fascinating stuff, Michael. Thank you so much, and we'll be right back after this message.
Okay.
Radio at freedomslips.com, and we'll be right back after this message.
Did you ever feel that things were not quite right? That everything was just ever so slightly askew?
Do you have, to paraphrase Morpheus, a splinter in your mind?
If you're interested in hearing the latest information about UFOs, the paranormal,
ancient cultures and structures,
monatomic elements,
longevity,
fantastic discoveries in science,
download it to your brain,
then Div.
And I'm Mackie.
And we are Shiny Side Out, Sundays 2 to 4 a.m. Eastern. See you then.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Revolution Radio. You're listening to Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Hi there, this is Carrie Cassidy, Project Camelot, Whistleblower Radio. We're interviewing Michael Schett, and we are on live stream simultaneously showing the photos one at a time as he talks about them. So go to http://, and then it's livestream.com/Project Camelot Live. And that will take you to our website, and you should, I mean, our live program. We're on number 44. Is that right, Michael?
That is correct, Carrie. One thing I want to mention about 44 is if you look on the top of the mothership, you'll see the parasitic aircraft there. That particular aircraft can take off under its own power. It uses two combined cycle turbo ramjet engines. And whatever people believe about Bob Lazar is their personal opinion, so I'm not going to get into that. But what I will say, John Andrews was interviewing Bob Lazar regarding the sport model that they were making for testers. Bob Lazar told John Andrews that when he heard the quote-unquote aurora take off from Groom Lake, it sounded like the sky was tearing. Now, not long after the interview, Gene Goodall and John Andrews were both at Little Alien in Rachel, Nevada, and Carrie, they heard the exact same noise that Bob Lazar had talked about. So I don't know if that, you know, vouches for Bob Lazar's story. That's just one more thing in his favor. And you can trust that if John Andrews stated that he heard that noise, it happened.
Okay, interesting. Right now, some people are complaining about the sound on your voice, Michael. I'm hoping that you could be understood. I guess some people are having
You keep leaving your microphone unmuted, and it's feeding back through your computer.
Well, that's not true, because I've been muted the whole time here. So I don't know what's going on, but what I will say is that we have a question here, and I want to ask Michael what it is what has become of all the videos from Wendell Stevens' library? Will they ever become available?
I'm not aware of any videos from Wendell Stevens. I guess, you know, we certainly did do interviews. I don't know what the result of that is, but the collection does exist, and I just can't comment on any videos. I'm not aware that Wendell Stevens had a video collection. His photos are a part of that collection, and his books are a part of that collection, but I'm just not aware of. Well, yeah, he did have videos, but There weren't anything there that was, you know, other than readily available type material. I guess I could say that. There wasn't any exclusive videos of alien beings in chambers or anything. There was nothing like that. But the books are a part of that collection, as well as the original photos. Still there, Carrie?
Okay, I was muted the whole time, so I just want to let people know that you are sounding a bit muffled to me as well. Anyway, we're on to number slide 45.
45, okay. This, Carrie, is the original aurora sighting. This is seen by Chris Gibson, who is on an offshore oil drilling platform called the Ellison Key. This is August 1989, and very quickly what he saw from the deck of this oil drilling platform when he looked up. Now, what we've done with this view, inverted view, so that you can see the top looking down. His viewing position was from the bottom looking up. He saw a KC-135, and then flanked on the left side of the KC-135 were two F-111s that had their wings spread out, and then directly in back of the KC-135 refueling plane, there was a black isosceles triangle that he could not identify. But what's interesting about Chris Gibson is he wasn't just your average person. His sighting is to be very well regarded as being something authentic because he was part of the Royal Observers Corps, and he was specifically trained to identify any aircraft in the world in less than 1 second. And he could not identify this aircraft. So this is the origin point of the Aurora story. Let's move on to 46. 46 is an illustration of the Astra, what we believe to be the craft that was involved in an incident at RAF Boscombe Down. This is September 26, 1994. Looked a lot like the Northrop YF-23, but it had a 75-degree swept-wing configuration. There was a crew of two, and on the application of military power, there was a nose gear failure. They towed this thing back into the hangar, and then eyewitnesses who this event carry, this is for 46 and 47, they said that there was a tarp covering the midsection of this craft, but the aft section and the nose were still visible, and this is an illustration based off of their testimony. So moving on to 48, this is the very famous USS FDR case. This was late 1958, which took place in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And this is the USS Franklin Delano Roosevelt, CVA 42. Just to be very quick, there was a commotion on the flight deck. Many of the naval officers were yelling at the people below deck to come up on deck. And when they did, they saw this orangish light descend. It got within 100 feet of the flight deck with at least 20 officers seeing this. And so it was multiple eyewitnesses. When it dropped down to just above the flight deck, they saw that it was in point of fact that this was, in fact, about 100 feet long cigar-shaped craft, and there were portholes in this craft that you can see on illustration number 49. We've put together an illustration to show you what they may have seen. And the officers on the aircraft carrier seeing all this said that when this thing dropped down above the flight deck, they could feel the heat emanating from this craft on their faces, and then this thing slowly departed at a higher rate of speed once it got out of the vicinity of the aircraft carrier. But they said that these beings were looking through these windows at the people on the flight deck. And we have the original report that is a MUFON case report and the whole description having the entire case.
Okay, and did you do this drawing? Who did the drawing?
I did do this drawing, yes.
That's great. It's just a lot of fun. Okay, continue, please.
Okay, we're going to move on to 50. 50 is an interesting case. I have on 50 a picture of the USS Wasp, which was on a training exercise, naval training exercise, 1963, off of Puerto Rico. And there were at least seven other ships, including two U.S. Navy submarines who were conducting this training mission. And if you look on 51 carry, they tracked a USO, an unidentified submerged object, go 150 knots at 27,000 foot depth. So I asked the question to anyone who's listening up there, this is a confirmed U.S. naval case, who had the technology in 1963 to be able to travel at that speed and at that depth? Very, very awkward, difficult to determine what exactly that was, but it was tracked by sonar on the naval submarine. Now, 52, Kerry, is June 14th, 1992, beneath the waves just off the coast of Catalina Island. Multiple people started seeing these white lights circling, and then things popped out of the ocean. This is illustration number 53, where they just emerged. 54 is a depiction of a craft that was seen with some scuba divers and local people, and it had a series of disc-shaped craft on the back end of it. So this is number 54 is February 7th of 1989.
I just got to stop right there. So 53, because you went real fast there. So 53 is actually the same as 52, only they're coming out of the water, correct?
That's exactly correct. That's exactly
okay.
Correct.
So people can catch up there. And then we went to 54, and what was the, continue, repeat the stuff about 54. Fascinating.
Okay, so 54 was seen by people on Catalina Island, and some scuba divers saw this as well. This is February 7th, 1989, near Catalina Island. They saw this particular craft, and then 55 shows it as it emerged from the waves. It sat on the top of the waves for about 30 seconds, but before it went back down, Carrie, if you go back to 54, you'll see that there's these six disc-shaped craft on the back spine of this vehicle. It launched these craft. They flew away and then dropped below the waves and disappeared. So this is another interesting USO case, because we know that at least 50% of UFO cases are, in point of fact, U.S. cases. I mean, they're even more important than UFO cases, because you're dealing with water here.
So, unidentified, what does it
stand for, USO? Unidentified submerged object.
Next one is
number 56. It was seen by a fisherman on August of 1967 in the Gulf north of Venezuela area. He started noticing that there was this boiling where he was. And then this strange turquoise spherical-shaped craft, about 3 feet in diameter, just hung and hovered about 3 feet off the waves there. And then this departed. It had a revolving section in the mid-portion of the vehicle. 57, Carrie, is a very interesting case here. This September 2nd of 1963, off the coast of Sardinia, West Italy, this is a radar operator case off of USS FDR. Their original contact was about 600 miles from the ship at an altitude of 80,000 feet. They were tracking this object. Not too long after that, they tracked it at about 15,000 feet altitude. At that point, they scrambled two F-4 Phantoms who tried to get a lock on this thing and intercept it. They tracked it on their radars going at a speed of 4,000 miles an hour back in 1963, and this was a confirmed case from the U.S. Navy, Carrie. That's number 57.
Okay, now I show that as being your last slide. Am I correct?
That is correct. That is correct.
Okay, I want to go back to 56, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Because this is a beautiful, beautiful painting. Who did this?
I did this one.
Wow.
I just created this craft, and then, you know, I tried to decide where this took place. So the report says it was in Venezuela, and it was August 4th, 1967. We have the name of the gentleman, Dr. Hugo Ypez. He was sitting in the Gulf, and the water began to boil. This thing popped out, and he said it was a bluish, gray turquoise globe hovering above the water. The midsection was rotating, and then this thing had these triangular windows, and then it departed. So, very interesting case.
Yeah.
The source is the UFO Investigator, Volume 4, March 5th of 1968.
Okay, and lovely looking little craft it is. Okay, now we've made it through, so is there anything you want to say before we take questions?
I want to say that I think it's important that these cases are finally looked at. Some of these cases have been buried for decades. I personally went through every file they had, about 3 years to do it, and some of the cases that we've talked about leaving are definitely covered. And I just think that they should get their time in the sun, because they've been buried in a dusty file for so long. And someone needs to just go through these cases and make them public. But, you know, after looking at this, Carrie, for 20 years now, and considering the USO cases, I mean, it's clear that there is a two-phase portion of this phenomenon. There is absolutely man-made UFOs, but then there are extraterrestrial UFOs as well, because Kelly Johnson had his own UFO sighting. In fact, he had two. And it's recording Project Blue Book. So I'm sure everyone knows who Kelly Johnson is. Now, if he said he saw something, you got to believe it.
You need to tell people Kelly Johnson. I know who he is, but you need to tell people.
Kelly Johnson is the founder of the Lockheed Skunk Works in Burbank, California. He's responsible for the design of the B-12, then the SR-71, but before all that, the U-2 spy plane. He worked directly with his co-pilot, Ben Rich, you could say, and Ben, according to this engineer's report that I recently got, is Kelly Johnson ruled the Skunk Works with his bad temper, and Ben Rich ruled the Skunk Works with his bad jokes.
Okay, great. I actually haven't heard that one, but very funny. Okay, fascinating stuff, Michael. Thank you so much. It's just great. And I have a person who is replaying. He asked the original question about those videos that Wendell Stevens had, and he is now supplying this amount of information. He says that apparently something about his, I don't know, former wife, Susie, putting things out on the curb, and that there were hundreds of videos. He said that he mentioned, I guess he means Wendell had mentioned that he had hours worth of Batallanos, brothers' videos, and Graham Bethune had hours worth of Batallanos, brothers' videos, and they have never been seen. Do you know anything about that?
All I would do is refer those questions to Open Minds personnel. I just don't know about what the current status is of that. I know that they have the world's largest collection of UFO photos. That's well known. That's common knowledge. They have Wendell's books. That's common knowledge. But regarding specific videos, I'm just not aware of it.
Okay, very good. So now I'm trying to find out whether we have some questions, and if anyone can help me determine if there are some questions that haven't been answered, it would be, and also if caller, anybody wants to call in, we have a few more minutes to take some calls here. I'm going to scan back through the chat here and see if I can find some questions. Have you gained a pair of Generation 3 or higher night vision goggles to look through these things like Ed Grimsley is the question.
I have not, but I have gone on one of Ed Grimsley's expeditions. I found it interesting. I don't know what those craft could be, or if they're extraterrestrial UFOs, but I definitely find it interesting. I do not have a pair by myself, no.
Okay, fine. And then if we do have any callers, feel free, producer Ahmad, to let me know. Otherwise, I will try to pull up my chat, and I did make it in there finally. Our site has been down this whole time. And so if you are in the chat, I can see the chat, and you can put your questions in all caps, and I'll try to get to them. It says, I don't see any clear questions here. If you want to add anything to what you've said so far, Michael, are you speaking, by the way, at the UFO Congress?
I am not speaking. No, I am not speaking.
Oh, my. Okay. Well, they're lost, I have to say, because you're such a great – he's a great speaker, everyone. And you know, if I had on my roster of time travel, I know it's your subject matter doesn't really go into that, but I am doing a conference, an Awake and Aware conference, on April 5th, 6th, and 7th. And you're welcome. By the way, all of our researchers and whistleblowers get in free, so you have a free – ticket if you can make it to the West Coast. I'd love to pay your way, but we don't have that kind of finances. But Michael is a great speaker, guys. Too bad he's not speaking at the UFO Congress this year. That's too bad. But here we have him, and this is really awesome. If I do make it over there, I will put a camera in front of you, Michael, and we will go through this whole thing again. But is there anything else you want to say, any particular case you want to go back to, and maybe now that we know we have a tiny bit of time here, and just maybe elucidate that particular case.
Yes, there is one other case I'd like to highlight, which we haven't talked about. Now, this is referenced in Ivan T. Sanderson's book called Invisible Residence. I just want to recommend this book to anyone who's interested in the subject matter, because he covers USOs better than anyone else in the world. He has the world's largest collection of USO reports. And one case in particular This is Operation Deep Freeze that took place between 1955 and 1956. This is in Admiralty Bay, the Antarctic region. And there were two scientists aboard this icebreaker, again, this is 1955-1956. And at around 9 p.m., something very peculiar happened. A bullet-shaped craft that was about 90 feet in length punched through 37 feet of solid ice, and then as it got through the ice, it carved this perfectly round circle, and then as this thing departed, these huge blocks of ice, you know, shot up into the air and landed near the ship, and then the water where this ring of ice was started boiling, and then this particular craft shot out into space. And this is reported in the U.S. Navy reports, and it's a part of his book. He describes this whole case in detail, and there were multiple eyewitnesses. So, again, who had this technology in 1955 to punch through 37 feet of solid ice? And we've got submarines, nuclear-powered submarines, that can ice too, but you know, maybe they only go through 3 or 4 feet. We're talking 37 feet of solid ice back in 1950. I'd just like to hear some comments from anyone who could explain what that might be.
Okay, great. All right, anything else that you want to add to this? I'm looking for questions. Ahmad, do we have anybody calling in?
No, ma'am.
Okay, well, that's very interesting. Somebody is saying, is it true 90% of the UFOs are from, I think the person means to say Earth or inner Earth, but I'm not sure which. You want to answer that question, Mike?
It's difficult to prove the exact number, but if you consider the Hudson boomerang, if you look at everything that Lockheed Skunk Works has been doing the last 40, 50 years, you look at what Northrop's been involved in, Boeing Phantom Works, Northrop Black Widow Group, there are multiple aircraft programs that mimic the form, fit, and function and flight dynamic path of what are reported as extraterrestrial UFOs. In fact, you know, Kerry, that discussion that Jim Goodall had with Ben Rich just before he passed away in 1995, where he called Ben on the phone because he wanted to do a non-holds-bar interview, because he knew that Ben was nearing the end there, and Ben actually agreed to it. He said yes, but that interview never took place, and he was going to tell. It would be something fantastic, because it would have been one. Ben was known as the keeper of the secrets. I don't know exactly what he would have said, but it's very clear if you look at the historical record here. Lockheed Skunk Works has been designing classified, unacknowledged special access programs for decades that have no public scrutiny. It's questionable whether even Congress knows about what they're doing. So to answer the question, a very large majority of these craft are probably man-made vehicles, but they might look and act and fly like extraterrestrial vehicles.
Okay, why didn't that interview ever take place?
Because Ben passed away. He passed away, and that interview never took place. It was going to be a recorded interview between Jim Goodall and Ben Rich, and he was going to sit him down and say, Ben, you know, I just don't know what he would have said, because Ben is very limited on what he could tell. I mean, he was the keeper of the secrets at the Skunk Works. What could he possibly reveal to Jim Goodall without breaking the law? Maybe he could have given him hints or something, or a direction to go in, but
let me just say, if he was that close to death, maybe he was going to spill the beans. Let me say, there's one more question here. Has Michael ever heard of electrogravitic saucers being tested on the Kola Peninsula in the Soviet Union in the early 1960s, both Bayfield Brown and Tesla Tech?
I've heard of the Bayfield Brown effect and Nikola Tesla's work. Yes, I've definitely researched electrogravitic propulsion systems. One thing I will point out:
in the Soviet Union,
the testing area there. No, I'm not familiar with that. I'm not familiar with that. But just as we're nearing the end here, Kerry, it's been well established by Richard Dolan and other researchers that the original research and development into electrogravitics and breakaway by Townsend Brown was like in the 1930s, but then within the aerospace literature, that research was, you know, well documented in 1955. By 1960, that research went black and it was expunged from aerospace literature. Aviation Week Space Technology didn't talk about it, and Jane's Defense Weekly didn't talk about it, but they used to talk about gravity engines, electropropulsion systems, atomic-powered aircraft, space vehicles. By 1960, all that disappeared. It's as though the black world flipped this switch and all that technology went into some secret program. But interesting, that is the exact same time that Harvey Lewis saw flux liner over Provo, Utah in 1960, the exact same time that this research went black.
Okay, can you describe that particular craft? Why do you link those two incidents? Why do you link it going black and that particular sighting?
Because the timing is uncanny. The very year, Dr. Greer, the very year that the electrogravitic and aircraft nuclear propulsion programs went into the black world is the same year that two pilots flying a C-47 over Provo, Utah in 1960 saw the alien reproduction vehicle. This is the very same thing that McCandless put up in front of, he testified before Congress at the National Press Club, basically. It's the same craft that was seen in a hangar at Air Force Plant 42, Palmdale hangar, L-1011 hangar at Lockheed's facility back in 1988. And if you look at the configuration, they match. So when we hear reports that there were fingerprints on this thing, it looked like it had been around for decades, it was smudged, it was beat up. Yes, it's true. It first flew in 1960. It was seen in 1988 in a hangar in Palmdale. So yes, it would be beat up. So that testimony rings true.
Okay. Well, we are at the end of the show. I want to thank you so much, Michael. We should definitely do this again. I'd love to have you back, and I will try to, if I catch the UFO Congress, I will come down and meet you there. Thank you again. Anything you want to say, parting words, your website, go ahead.
No other words, but I just think keep looking at Lockheed Skunk Works, and that's the direction to go into.
Thanks very much, Michael.
Take care, Kurt.
You've been listening to Revolution Radio.
We're an anarcho-syndicalist commune. We take it in turns to act as a sort of executive officer for the week.
Yes.
But all the decisions of that officer have to be ratified at a special bi-weekly meeting.
Yes, I see.
By a simple majority in the case of purely internal affairs.
Be quiet.
But by a two-thirds majority in the case of more...
Be quiet.
I order you to be quiet.
Look, you stupid bastard. You've got no arms left.
Yes, I have. Look.
Just a flesh wound.
I don't believe I've seen such a display of courage, skill, nerve, grace, and stupidity.
I'll do you for that.
Oh, what?
Come here. What are you going to do, bleed on me? I'm invincible.
You're a loony.
The Black Knight always triumphs. Round